Welcome to We Empower, the radio show that inspires you to embrace your potential, resilience, and strength. In these challenging times, we're here to help you unlock your power to overcome obstacles, pursue your dreams, and shape a brighter future. I'm Anna Martinez, your host for this empowering hour. Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of We Empower. I'm thrilled to have you all with us today. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired. Let's make today count. In today's episode, we will have a great guest here to introduce, explore the roots of health, nutrition, and psychotherapy with one of the leading voices in nutritional psychotherapy, Professor Dr. Dr. Sabrina Leal Garcia. So afterwards, we will review an inspiring book with a reading. But first, let's kick things off with a song selected by Professor Dr. Dr. Sabrina Leal Garcia.
Twas in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. And if I pass this way again, you can rest assured I'll always do my best for her, on that I give my word. In a world of steel eyed death and men who are fighting to be warm, come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from the storm. Not a word was spoke between us, there was little risk involved. Everything up to that point had been left unresolved. Try imagining a place where it's always safe and warm. Come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from the storm. Burned out from exhaustion, buried in the hail, poisoned in the bushes and blown out on the trail. Hunted like a crocodile, ravaged in the corn. Come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from the storm. Suddenly I turned around and she was standing there, with silver bracelets on her wrists and flowers in her hair. She walked up to me so gracefully and took my crown of thorns. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Now there's a wall between us, something that's been lost. I took too much for granted, I got my signals crossed. Just pretend till it all began on a non-eventful morn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Well, the deputy walks on hard nails and the preacher rides a mount, but nothing really matters much, it's doom alone that counts. And the one-eyed undertaker, he blows a feudal horn. Come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from the storm. I've heard newborn babies wailing like a moaning dove, and old men with broken teeth stranded without love. Do I understand your question, man? Is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from.
Welcome here to the show, Professor Dr. Dr. Sabrina Leal Garcia. You are a true pioneer at the crossroads of medicine, psychiatry, psychosomatics, and nutrition. Welcome here on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're not only a medical doctor, psychotherapist, and scientist, but you're also one of Europe's leading experts in nutritional psychiatry. And from your early days in clinical research to founding your own center in Graz, Austria, you have dedicated your career to exploring how our minds and bodies interact, especially when it comes to food, mental health, and the gut-brain axis. So we will talk about your journey, scientific breakthroughs, and practical insights today, which hopefully a lot of people who are listening can apply to your own life. So I would like to start a bit unconventional with a song you selected. It is Shelter from the Storm. And it is interesting because we just had stormy weather around us. And maybe it's a bit, this line serves a line coming, I will give a shelter from the storm, serves as the emotional and symbolic core of the song and represents grace, forgiveness, and unconditional love in a harsh, unforgiving world. Could you tell us why you've chosen this song?
This song kind of, for me, it is a very important song. I heard it, I think, the first time when I was still a small child, and it touched something within me. And I thought, because this is something also like the whole experience we have in life. There is something that cracks us open, that challenges us, and at the same time, something that gives us shelter. And for me, it was very important. I've seen it through my life that there are these both sides which are very important for growth.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, we have a world full of loss, pain, and disillusionment, right? And it has been like this for the couple of centuries, I'd say. So I think this line underscores also there's the smallest gesture of kindness or emotions, positivity, a moment of connection or compassion can be a transformation for each of us. And it's a kind of longing for a return of that we get back to our feelings, right?
Yes, and that these things can exist exactly at the same time also. So regardless of all the chaos we are experiencing, and also all the turmoil that's behind the scenes, that there is something as empathy, as love, as connectedness, as kindness. And I think this is something also what the song tries to teach.
Yeah. So if we go from the song to your childhood, where did you grow up, and what role did health or science play in your early life?
I grew up in a small town in eastern Austria, so near the Hungarian border. I was born into a working class family. So my father was a roofer, my mom was a secretary, and I was actually the first one in my family to pursue a university degree. So this
Wow.
was really something special. So you see, health and science were not really like a central part in my upbringing in any formal sense, I would say, but I always was a curious child, so I had a deep curiosity for the human body and how the mind works. And I spent lots of time in nature. I wanted to discover things. So it was rather like observation and not so much structured education. And I knew that in nature there were so many stories, and I wanted to learn how to read them.
And were there specific moments in your childhood that sparked your curiosity? Maybe you can share one situation with us.
Actually, when I was like 4 or 5 years old, I spent quite a long time in hospital. I had a growth disorder of my hip joint. And so I had to lie very still, like 4 weeks, because it was painful. Every move I made was painful. And so I was kind of a quiet observer of all the things happening around me. So I watched all, you know, the other patients at the ward, the nurses, the doctors, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. There were some things that fascinated me, but also I saw, oh, maybe it would be nice to have some other things at the wards, and there are some improvements needed. And this sparked my first interest in medicine and my curiosity to be in this field.
Nice. And did you always want to work in healthcare, or was your career a kind of path?
I think it evolved like over time, so step by step. I did when I was small, I did not have like a clear image of becoming a scientist or a medical doctor or doing nutritional psychiatry. But I wanted to know why do people suffer? Why? What does? What is the root of many illnesses? What helps heal? And how does the mind and the body interact? And so later, my interest developed in the direction of psychiatry, psychosomatics, nutrition, the gut microbiome. But at the time, I thought it is just, developing step by step.
And who were your early role models? You said your parents might have haven't been your role models there because of their professional career, but have you had role models?
I would say my role model for life would be my grandparents, because I spent lots of time with my grandparents, especially with my grandmother, and she did not have like any academic experience or career herself, but she had some, what you would say, like some grounded wisdom, or she had a very sensitive way of caring for people and navigating life. She was full of strength, and this left a very deep impression on me. And for my scientific career, I had many great teachers. For example, also I spent half a year at the APC Microbiome Institute with Professor Dynan and Professor Cryan. And I think what always impressed me with the people and the teachers I met on my path were that they had this connection between also like thinking about the data behind, but also see the people.
Great. This is, of course, a great, great gift that the human factor is there, also the social, the emotional part. And how did your time at the medical university shape your research perspective in the field that you figured out that it's important to bring these parts together?
So I would say that the medical university like provided me the foundation, and I had the freedom there to pursue my research interests. And this is like a new field also for the whole field of psychiatry. Of course, we had something like psychoneuroimmunology, but nutritional psychiatry was especially a very new field, and I'm very grateful that the Medical University of Graz provided me the time also, and also the background where I could start exploring this emerging field. And as I said, the other formative experience for me was my time abroad in Ireland, where I have seen the APC Microbiome Institute and met some leading researchers there. And this profoundly influenced my thinking and deepened also my understanding, and also to understand how interconnected the systems truly are.
And you already said it's a growing field, this nutritional psychotherapy. And it's a field, and I'd say, I mean, everybody should know about this, and everybody should know about this combination of the things, because in the school medicine, we often look at shelves, often look at boxes, and we like to put the things into or give the things a name, and then say, okay, it belongs there, but we don't like if it's something special, or we have to combine things and get something new or individual, because it makes it harder to use things and results we already have. What's one scientific insight about nutrition and the brain and the gut that everyone might should know?
I think it's really important to bridge the disciplines. So that you say, okay, there is a connection between the different body systems, because what we learn, like in general medicine, for example, we have one chapter about the immune system, one chapter about the endocrine system, one chapter about I don't know about every organ, but we never know how these things are interconnected. So this is one really important insight for me was when we were starting our research on the vagus nerve, because this is the nerve that mainly connects all parts of the body with the brain. It's also so important for emotion, for emotional recognition, for morbidity, for mortality. So this is the major connection pathway between also the gut and the brain, and it can influence also our levels of inflammation. And this is one thing I would say everyone should know about, that we can support the function of our vagus nerve not only through proper sleep, but also proper nutrition and a healthy gut microbiome.
Yeah, this is super important, I think, because many people still think that mental illness is just is not possible to heal, and it's only possible to work with this with medicine, which puts the symptoms down, right? And the combination of psychological illness or mental health with nutrition is very new, and people don't like. I have often the feeling that people don't like also to understand that, in a kind of don't take me away the red meat. I want to continue eating this red meat, and so behavior, which is a kind of which has nothing to do with if it's good for our body or bad for our body, but if it is a kind of how do you say feeling good. Which comes from experiences we have with a drink or with something to eat, or which feels like home or is connected to feelings, which have nothing to do with that.
Yeah, and it's often not about single foods, it's about the diversity of foods. Because some say, oh, I have this and that superfood I need to eat, and this one thing makes me healthy. It's not the one thing. It's like, here we see it again, this interconnectedness of things. We need a diversity. If what we eat is diverse, also the gut microbiome gets more diverse. And if we have diversity inside us, the vagus nerve can work. The organs are interconnected, also interconnected with our psyche, and also the social connections that we can make to others can then develop to be even more strong. And so I think the future, one of the main future aims of medicine should be to see these connections between the dots.
Connecting the dots is a very important point, also supporting the dots, right? So, if you, and we have maybe one last question before the break. What were the biggest challenges and breakthroughs in your academic journey, or where you would say, yes, this is something what I figured out, what is really amazing, or what is really important to know? I mean, you shared a little bit with us already.
Yeah, I think the biggest challenges were because it was a new field. Also, many colleagues said, oh, you know, this is kind of alternative medicine and it does not really belong to us. And why should psychiatrists be interested in food and nutrition and stuff like this? So there were, yeah, it was quite challenging sometimes also to talk to my colleagues because we needed a whole other vocabulary. And here you see also this problem that that in medicine there are so many subspecialties and they never talk to each other, and so sometimes this vocabulary is missing. And for me, one important thing and also breakthrough is to get these different subspecialties to talk with each other and to make these connections in order to help people, also to bring the things we knew from our research to the clinic to fill this gap.
I think this is super important because you have everyday patients in your hospital which are suffering and which often come to you after a long, long journey they have behind them, desperate, sometimes really wrongly medicated. So I'm very happy to talking further after the small break. So stay tuned with us 2 minutes and we see again each other in approximately 2 minutes.
Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
I'm happy to talk further with one of the leading voices in nutritional psychotherapy, Professor Dr. Sabrina Leal Garcia. We discussed before the break the topic about patients which come from a long, long journey often to seeing you, and you're often the only hope for them because your perspective is often different. You just said you have colleagues also from school medicine who have different perspective, of course, on the idea of psychiatry, on the idea how much nutrition plays a role there. And we talked about your biggest challenges or breakthroughs where you said, this is the part where the things come together, and I understood how the things play a role together and are showing also a solution. So if we go a little bit deeper into this, can you once explain again what is your approach makes your approach unique compared to traditional therapy or just nutrition counseling?
Yes, we started our outpatients department for nutritional psychiatry over 1 year ago. And I think what makes our approach different is that we take lots of time to see our patients. So if you have like the first appointment, it would take like 1.5 hours. We do a complete biopsychosocial anamnesis. So we ask kind of everything, even things that are seemingly not related to the primary complaint, because we want to have a full picture. And I think this is a very important thing, because when patients come to see us, they have already been, I don't know where, to many different colleagues. They often come, with 2 kilograms of letters from every kind of doctor, and so we take time to first, of course, to see the patient and to see him or her on the whole. And I think this is also what needs to be a foundation of this medicine. And we, of course, we also ask questions that a normal psychiatrist would not ask, questions regarding what do you eat, but not only what do you eat, also how do you eat and when, and also why, what are the main reasons, what emotions do you have with that. So we are interested in the whole being sitting in front of us. And this is also what makes medicine interesting for us, because every day we learn something new from and with our patients.
And what are the most common misconceptions people have about emotional eating? Because you just mentioned this.
Mm-hmm. So I would say with regard to emotional eating, it's very important, because it's one of the main things how we can handle stress And it also, our brain is kind of wired. If we are in lots of pressure, in lots of stress, we tend to then grab some chips. And what we're also addressing behavioral therapy. So, for example, we try to teach them to not only go for the chips or the chocolate, but to notice kind of this gap in between when you think, now I have like a really strong emotion. It's interesting that I have it now, so that you think about your thoughts. We try, it's called also meta perception or meta thinking, and this can help with emotional eating and also to keep the nervous system and the vagus nerve calm and supportive in this case.
This is super interesting. Are there distinct psychological patterns that underlie obesity or and eating disorders?
There are. I would say, of course, each person's story is unique, but there are some common patterns, I would say. So underlying eating disorders or obesity, there is often trauma, there is often stress, there is often emotional dysregulation, also dysregulation of the vagus nerve. And many individuals we see, especially also with eating disorders, with anorexia nervosa, they struggle with problems with self-worth, with perfectionism. So everything has to be really perfect, and they tend to feel really like disconnected from themselves, from their bodies. So, and from a physiological perspective, of course, there are also common pathways like the chronic inflammation, like hormonal imbalances, like microbiome disturbances that also play a role. And so, if you work like purely from a psychotherapeutic perspective, this one approach can fall short. But I think we need to look at the whole picture, the biological side, the emotional side, and the relational side in treatment. And this is what we do also in our outpatients department.
That sounds wonderful. It sounds like your hospital needed to be in every country and every city to help the people.
I hope
Because
that
I
there
mean
will other people be doing the same thing in other countries. I think I heard that there are other outpatients departments with our approach starting in Germany and Switzerland. So I
Wow,
hope in
that
the future there will be more possibilities for the patients to
Oh,
find adequate care.
this is really great news. How or what would you say? I mean, what major social or culture barriers are still there when we talk about food and health, which are barriers also for your work?
I would say one of the barriers is, as we talked about it before, is this reductionism that we still talk about food, or if we think about food, we think about calories, we think about weight, or we think about guilt. It's not about connection. It's not about if this is something that could help me healing, or this could help me with my resilience. There is still this mind-body split, very common in medicine, so that mental health is something really different from physical health, and nutrition has nothing to do with if it is superficial. It's rather like for aesthetics or losing weight. So I think we need like a cultural shift also from that eating is not something about control. It's about care. It's about self-agency. It's about that we need the information, but also that it has something to do with our emotions and relationships.
How do you stay motivated in such a demanding and evolving field? Because, I mean, if I look around me myself, I see a lot of frustration around me, hidden aggression, depression, and if we look at anxiety and this field of food and I currently I'm sometimes shocked what I see around me, even when I look a little bit deeper at the people's life or behavior or their vision, mission, if there is one.
I would say, for me, my motivation comes from my work, because from my scientific work, but also from my work being with patients, because I see what is possible. Because also from the perspective, I've watched patients come back to life, you know, to be more stable and more whole. And I also have the privilege to work with incredible colleagues here at the Medical University of Graz. I learn something new every single day. The science is moving really fast now. So we have like new publications out on the gut microbiome, gut brain axis and nutrition every day. And what keeps me motivated is that there is so much beauty also in this work, that we learn so much about our environment, but also about ourselves. And we managed now helping quite a few people. And for me, I always remind myself, if I can even help one person, so this is enough. And so I keep doing it.
Great. I mean, you said it's your job. It's also that what you feel or what you get back from patients, I think, when you their thankfulness, but also that you see that they are growing, that you could help them. What's one health habit you personally never skip?
I have a very busy life myself, so habit I never skip is like eating mindfully. So take my time. I sit down and eat regularly, no matter how busy or stressful the day is. I eat slowly. I take the time to really taste my food. It sounds simple, but it's like it's nourishing, and I love to eat with presence.
That sounds good. I mean, we know, and we talked also beforehand, that eating food is something which is very individual. So you can't say, for example, there's this brain food everybody should eat because maybe one have an allergy against fruit sugar. But are there any specific brain foods you swear by?
What we recommend, so for many of our patients, the Mediterranean diet is the diet to follow. But we always recommend, if there are no special gut problems, to have fermented foods as well. So such as kefir or kimchi, also lots of berries because of the polyphenols, walnuts, omega-3 rich fish. But as you said, it's more than one single food. We in our outpatients department, we totally believe in diversity. We say that food should be colorful, it should be fiber rich, it should be anti-inflammatory, it should support the gut microbiome, and it should taste good and bring you happiness.
It's funny because I would like to share one experience of end of last year. I spent some time in India at an Ayurveda retreat, and after a few days of fasting, I got some food which looked really not good, and I said, why can't you prepare food which looks good? He said, food which is looking good is not good for your body. I said, I think that is, I can't sign this, because I mean, we have so great looking food and the nature, berries, bananas. I mean, it's sometimes a color explosion. If you tell me this, this is something I don't understand from the Ayurvedic understanding of nurturing the body and the mind.
I think it's so important to really have something on your plate that is colorful and that makes fun eating it, because this is also what we see in hospitals. The patients are served food which really it has only like two colors, gray and yellowish white, and this, it does not look healthy, and really it is not healthy because it lacks the polyphenols. So our eyes are also trained to see which substances are good for us, and in the old days, the most colorful things you could find to eat were fruits and vegetables, and of course this be integrated in the diet, and it's the major part of the Mediterranean diet.
Yeah, I think so too. And do you follow any mental health or mindfulness routines also? Because you just said, and I can really imagine that you have a very full day and maybe also stressful, maybe positive stressful, but I think sometimes really stressful.
Yes, actually, I only have some breaths in between tasks, and this is my regular moments of stillness. So like breathing, grounding, there's also this, what we learn in psychotherapy, coherence breathing. So 5 seconds in, 6 or 7 seconds out breath. And when I have the time, I just go for a walk, I look at the sky. I love to be in nature because this is where I can recalibrate, and this is my mental health and mindfulness routine.
I think this is I think the best recipes are often the recipes nature gives us, right? Because I mean, we come from nature, we are part of the nature, and seeing us that we unifies with nature or get back to nature would give us also more power, right? I mean, if you look at the journey of your field and what it can create in a society, where do you see the future of nutritional psychotherapy heading in the next 10 years?
I hope, or I believe, that nutritional psychiatry will become a core component in psychiatric care. At least this is my wish. Before I retire, I want to see that nutritional psychiatry is integrated into psychiatric guidelines, in medical education, and in our daily clinical practice. And I also would love to see it to become even more personalized. That, of course, in the future, we will have even more data from a person. We can combine microbiome data, biomarkers, data from the vagus nerve through heart rate variability. So digital tools, also maybe artificial intelligence, will help us with that. But my wish would also be that we don't lose this human connection, and that treatment can also that we don't need treatment anymore, and that it can transform into prevention and preventive medicine, so to support brain health before an illness can take hold.
Yeah, very important point. We have, unfortunately, just time left for one question. What message would you like to leave our listeners with, especially those struggling with food, self-image, or mental well-being?
I would say, your symptoms are not failures, they are signals. And behind the signals, there is always a story. And this story is worth listening to. And this, it does not happen in a doctor's appointment within 10 minutes. So look for a doctor who has time. And your healing can take time. It's not about perfection. It's about reconnection. You need to learn how to reconnect to your body, to your needs, to your own rhythm. And food can be a part of your healing journey.
Thank you so much. It was a great talk with you, with one of the leading voices in nutritional psychotherapy. And I hope that we stay connected. And then I hope that we can connect dots and try to make the world a better place. So thank you very much for being here, sharing your insights, and showing us also how positive you are. Because I think in these days where crises, transformation, a lot of uncertainty gives people a tendency into depression and a mental illness. It is more important than ever to understand that sometimes the small little things which can help you on a day, the blueberries, maybe the yellow banana, maybe the green salad, to give you a great start into the day. So thank you very much for the engaging discussion and the inspiring insights. And I look very much forward to our ongoing exchange. Yes, and the impact we will continue to make together. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. So after the commercial break, we'll continue with the introduction of an inspiring book that we've selected for you. Thank you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
this the year you're going to sort out your health goals? Never heard of frequency medicine, but willing to give it a try? Curious to discover there is a way to click your way to optimal health? At BioHealthScan, we found a way for you to recover your lost good health faster than conventional methods, in a safe and pain-free way. Join in with the rest of us and try our 21-day challenge for optimal health. Do it yourself, save ourselves today. Find your way to biohealth-scan.com/21-day-challenge. Or, for a whopping 20% discount, click on the BioHealthScan 21-Day Challenge DIY SOS banner on the UK Health Radio homepage now. BioHealthScan, paving the way to manage your health a better way.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So now let's move on to with the introduction of an inspiring book I selected for you. Today it's My Mother, Myself. And I would like to start with a small review about this book. I cried while reading My Mother, Myself, Not the Count of Tears. They come from heartbreak, but those from a slow, aching recognition the moment you see yourself on a page unmasked. Nancy Friday's words didn't just speak to me. They echoed. They reached into the silent spaces between my relationships and especially the one with my mother and gave language to feelings I had long buried under rules, expectations, and daughter quite well. Reading this book felt like sitting across from a very bright friend who is telling the truth. No one else dares to say that our mothers live within us, their love, their pain, their fears, and their limitations. And that if we don't untangle our own identities from theirs, we may never fully live as ourselves. What moved me most was Friday's ability to weave the personal and the political, the biological and the emotional into a seamless narrative. She offers no easy comfort, but she does offer insight. And for that, I'm deeply grateful. This book is not simply about mothers. It's about the woman you are because of your mother, in spite of your mother, and sometimes instead of your mother. It's a brave journey in word. And when you finish it, you'll feel both shattered and soon together, but this time by your own hands. Nancy Friday, 1933 until 2017, was an American author and feminist pioneer known for her groundbreaking work exploring female sexuality, identity, and gender roles. She grew up in Charleston, South Carolina, raised primarily by her mother and grandmother, a complex maternal lineage that deeply influenced her work. After graduating from the University of Michigan, she worked as a journalist and editor, contributing to Esquire, Cosmopolitan, and McCall's. Friday's writing challenged the taboos of her time, particularly around women's fantasies and psychological development. Her debut book, My Secret Garden, was revolutionary, offering raw, anonymous female sexual fantasies that shocked and liberated audiences. She became a symbol of second-wave feminism, not because she towed the line, but because she dared to break it. She was fascinated by how women internalize social and familial expectations. Her focus was not just on sexual liberation, but on the emotional and psychological scaffolding that keeps women trapped in roles they didn't choose. Nancy Friday's work was deeply personal and fiercely intellectual. She sought to understand how we become who we are and how we can reclaim our autonomy. My mother and myself, the daughter's search for identity, was born from Nancy Friday's own introspective re-knocking with the influence of her mother and her personal development. Following the success of her earlier books on female sexuality, Friday turned to explore the psychological inheritance passed from mother to daughter. She believed that mothers consciously are not imprint their daughters with emotional blueprints. These range from body shame or fear of independence, from romantic expectations to deep-rooted feelings of inadequacy. Friday saw a profound psychological conflict in women, the desire to please the mother and the need to become oneself. The book emerged at a time when second-wave feminism was blooming, yet emotional conversations around mothers and daughters remained a taboo. Friday dared to say what many women felt but couldn't articulate, that sometimes the mother-daughter bond isn't just loving, it's suffocating. This book is not an accusation, but an invitation to understand, to grieve, and to ultimately to liberate. She wrote it not to blame mothers, but to give daughters permission to question the emotional inheritance they had quietly accepted. After reading, I would like to give you 7 tips and lessons from the book I got. First is, examine the voice inside you. Ask whether the guilt, fear, or doubt you feel is really yours, or if it belongs to your mother. Separate love from approval. Learn to distinguish between loving your mother and needing her constant validation. Your sexuality is yours. Reclaim your essential identity from the shame or silence you may have inherited. Motherhood doesn't define womanhood. Being a daughter doesn't mean you must repeat your mother's life choices. Anger can be healthy. Repressed anger toward your mother can turn into depression. Facing it can be liberating. Don't idolize or demonize. Your mother is a complex human being. Understanding her story may help you understand your own one. Be the mother you needed to yourself. Healing begins when you start parenting your own emotional needs. So, my mother myself is a bold psychological exploration, and it's something for men and women. And I put some quotes from the book here before reading. When a daughter begins to understand her mother as a woman, she begins to understand herself. The struggle to separate from the mother is a central struggle of every woman's life. We must unlearn what we were taught and teach ourselves to be who we are. So many women try to live their mother's unlived life and lose their own in the process. Until a woman lets go of the mother inside her, she cannot hear her own voice. So with that, I would like to start and step into the book. And reading it, it's hard to find one side, one page, which is really the best. So I thought I'll start with the first. In 1973, I picked up a book that correlated women's orgasmic potential with the degree of security they once had with their fathers. I can remember the day where I was sitting, the weight of the volume in my hands, and my instant reaction, what about mother? I had just written a book on women's sexual fantasies and left no doubts in my mind where repression or sexual acceptance begins. Who first takes our hand away from our genitals? Who implants pleasure or inhibition about our bodies? Who lays down the rules and with her own life gives us an indelible model? That week I wrote an outline for a book entitled Mothers and Daughters, The First Lie. I thought by myself a good candidate for the subject because although I would have told you I loved my mother, I also felt sufficient psychological space between us, a separation that would allow me to be fair and objective, as if any woman could. It took 2 years of research to get beyond the anger in that first title, even to recognize how angry I was. My intention was to do a series of interviews with mothers and daughters within a family, and where possible with grandmothers too. And these last 4 years, I interviewed more than 200 women across the United States. Most were mothers, all were daughters. On the most meaningful level, they were experts. But I quickly learned that a week of interviews would not be enough. I had hoped to avoid the subject through finding patterns that would hold for most women. By tracing these patterns through the generations, we could see the conscious and unconscious repetitions, correct for the best in our maternal inheritance, and go rich for a day of rest. If women's lives are going to change, we must have access to the formative strength of that relationship. We must get past the anger at lies told us for our own good, find what real love exists between mother and daughter, or be freed from illusion of a love that never existed at all. I was looking for a clarification. I discovered a rational one. Mother, I very carefully prepared my daughter for menstruation. Daughter, my mother taught me nothing. Two versions of the same story, different and yet the same. Neither woman thinks she's lying. To understand contradictions like these, I talked to psychiatrists, educators, doctors, lawyers, sociologists. I did not want textbook answers alone. Of the 21 professional women quoted in this book, 16 are mothers of daughters themselves. No woman gave more generously of her wit, wisdom, professional knowledge, and personal life than Dr. Leah Schaefer. I will always be in her dad and her death. What is most poignant to me is how often these highly trained people confess difficulties in applying what they intellectually knew to their own lives. One of my earliest discords was the notion that I could learn all I needed from women. We can hop instead of walk, but why not use two legs? When Dr. Sergei Sanger telephoned in answer to my request to interview a certain eminent child psychiatrist, a woman, he informed me she was out of town. She had asked him to take my call. Rather impolitely, I said that since I believed women understood women best, I would wait for his female colleague to return. I'm grateful to this day he did not hang up on me. Some of the possibilities of conduct and insights into behavior, which are the most rare and exhilarating in these pages, come from him and other men. They have daughters too. I first talked to Dr. Richard Ruppertiello on an afternoon like any other. It was one of the shaping events of my career and began a series of conversations over the years without which this book would have been immeasurably poorer. As the reader follows the development of the argument, I hope it becomes clear that before I could explain the mother-daughter relationship, I had to understand my own. So I would have given up long ago. And so this is a start, and it was a start for me on a long, long journey. I always lied to my mother and she to me. How young was I when I learned her language to call things by other names? 5, 4, younger? Her denial of whatever she could not tell me, that her mother could not tell her, and about which society enjoined us both to keep silent, disturbed our relationship still. Sometimes I try to imagine a little scene that could have helped us both. In a kind, warm, shy, and self-depreciating way, mother calls me into the bedroom where she sleeps alone. She's no more than 25. I'm perhaps 6. Putting her hands on my shoulders, she looks me right through my steel-rimmed spectacles. Nancy, you know I'm not really good at this mothering business. She says, you're a lovely child. The fault is not with you, but motherhood doesn't come easily to me. So when I don't seem like other people's mothers, try to understand that it's not because I don't love you. I do, but I confused myself. There are some things I know about. I will teach them to you. The other stuff, sex and all that, well, I just can't discuss them with you because I'm not sure where they fit into my own life. Well, try to find other people, other women who can talk to you and fill the gaps. You can expect me to be all the mother you need. And you can't expect me to be right. I feel closer to your age in some ways than I do to my mother's. I don't feel that serene, divine, earth-mother certainty you're supposed to that she felt. I'm unsure how to raise you, but you're intelligent, and so I am. Your aunt loves you. Your teachers already feel the need in you. With their help, with what I can give, we will see that you get the whole mother package and all the love in the world. It's just that you can't expect to get it all from me. a scene that could never have been taken place. For as long as I can remember, I did not want the kind of life my mother, she could show me. Sometimes I think she did not want it either. The older I get, the farther away she gets from her childhood, from her ironclad role as my mother, the more interesting woman she becomes. Perhaps she should never have been a mother. Certainly, she was one too soon. I look at her today, and with all the love and anger in the world, I wish she had had a chance to live another life. Mine, perhaps, but hers was not an age in which women felt that they had a choice. I have no idea when I began to perceive with the monstrous selfishness that dependency lends to a child's eyes that my mother was not perfect. I was not her whole life. Was it at the same age that I began to make the terrible judgment that she was not the woman I wanted to be? It seems I have always known both. It accounts for my guilt at leaving her and my anger that she let me go. But I'm sure that she has always known on a level her indoctrinated attitudes toward motherhood would never let her admit that my sister and I were not enough. We had not brought the certification of womanhood that her mother had promised, that once in her life, sex and a man had been more important than motherhood. A more dutiful daughter than I, my mother wanted to accept the view of reality my grandmother taught her. She lied with the rest. She subverted herself. Her genuine feelings, those burgeoning intimations of life, hope, and adventure, which she found in my father and which induced her to elope with them against her family's wishes, all lost in the name of being a good mother. Her mother's rules had the authority of the entire culture behind them. There was no such thing as such a bad mother. There were only bad women. They were the explicitly sexual ones who lived out the notion that what went on between themselves and their husbands had at least as much right to live as their children. They had little maternal instinct. We are raised to believe that mother love is different from other kids and other kinds of love. It is not open to error, doubt, or to the ambivalence of ordinary affections. This is an illusion. Mothers may love their children, but they sometimes do not like them. The same woman who may be willing to put her body between her child and a runaway truck will often resent the day-by-day sacrifice the child unknowingly demands on her time, sexuality, and self-development. So it's interesting to read further and know also what this time a woman who has some self-insights on this relationship, professional and individual, also from her own life, tells about that. What she tells about how important the relationship is to a mother, not just for daughters, but also for sons, and what it makes with someone who's grown up. So maybe you're taking something out of this for yourself, or has a perhaps picked your curiosity and trust enough to want to read the book. If any of you have book recommendations, of course, you like to share in general, just let me know. I often get some books and I like to do it because it's you who are important to this. So that wraps up our episode of We Empower, the weekly radio show dedicated to celebrating the strength, resilience, and limitless potential of women and men around the globe. Join us again next week as we continue on this empowering journey, sharing great stories of triumph and empowerment. Your presence means the world to me and to us, and we appreciate you taking the time to tune in. Remember, this time is a gift for you. Don't hesitate to get involved in any manner. Your voice is valued. Thank you for being part of our community. And until next week, keep shining and empowering others. However the world looks around you, together we rise.
Was in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you.